Hello and welcome to the Richards Report. I'm Ted Richards. I was recently over in New York, ticked off a goal that I've wanted to do, which is running the New York Marathon. I also visited some of the successful cafe chains spread throughout the US, owned by previous podcast guests, Nick Stone of Bluestone Lane and Joe Watson from Hole in the Wall. I also sat down and recorded a few podcast episodes with some notable American guests that I'd been meaning to speak with for a while, one of which is this episode, where I'm speaking with Scott Galloway. If you're not aware of Scott, he's a professor of marketing at the New York University Stern School of Business, a public speaker, and co-host of the fantastic podcast called Pivot. And make sure you check that out if you haven't already listened to it. He's also an author of two best-selling books, and he's an entrepreneur too. If you're a fan of his work like I am, you might even know of him as the Big Dog. However, it's in recent times where Scott has become increasingly well-known around the world. He was the first, and probably by far the loudest, to make a call out on the high valuations on the planned WeWork IPO for 2019 for this year, and questioned the money that SoftBank and the Vision One Fund was pumping into the WeWork business. WeWork became a bit of an iconic failed IPO in a matter of weeks, maybe even days, when it went from a planned $47 billion valuation to somewhere around a fifth of that, maybe even less, depending on when you're listening to this episode, as he predicted even more hard times ahead for WeWork. A lot of this comes back to the fact that Scott was not merely following the crowd and buying into the hype like so many can with a well-marketed and exciting new IPO, but really questioning their business model and their valuation. We really cover a lot this episode, from WeWork, which I've already mentioned, to his new book, The Algebra of Happiness, which is all about where real happiness comes from. And as you'll soon discover, as much as I wanted to ask Scott all the questions, Scott wanted to ask me a lot of questions about my background too. As always, the usual disclosures, this does not qualify as financial advice and is just for informational purposes only, and people may hold positions in the companies discussed. But I'm pretty sure Scott doesn't own any WeWork. As always, show notes for this episode will be available on the Six Park website, sixpark.com.au, sixpark.com.au. Make sure you subscribe wherever you get your podcasts from. And if you liked this episode and enjoyed it, please share it with a friend. Okay, that's it from me. I'm Ted Richards. You're listening to The Richards Report. And with no further ado, here is my chat with Scott Galloway, professor at NYU and the Big Dog.
You're listening to The Richards Report, where we will speak with investment experts from around the country. We will cut through the jargon to allow you to make more insightful investment decisions for your future. This is The Richards Report.
Scott, you originally wanted to be a professional athlete, but it didn't work out. I read that you said it was a blessing. Why was that?
Yeah, let me be clear. I was blessed with an early recognition I wasn't going to be able to make money in sports. I wasn't even good enough to make the teams in my high school. I ended up rowing crew in college, but I got to know a lot of world-class athletes, guys who went on to the Olympics and who were just superb kind of 0.01 percenters. And I would argue that I was blessed with being a mediocre athlete because it got me focused on business or things that were the employment rate is 99% as opposed to the unemployment rate of 99% in some of the passion fields like sports. So I think sports are a fantastic way to develop discipline, develop skills, create great friends. And hopefully over the course of your life, you learn and develop a passion for exercise and sweating that I think has a ton of benefits. But I think you want to be a mediocre to good athlete, but I think being a great athlete is almost a bit of a curse because even amongst the great athletes, very few of them make a living at it. And I actually have quite a few contacts from UCLA who started their lives in their late 20s, their professional lives instead of their early 20s, because they were under the illusion they could make a living as athletes. So I was blessed with mediocrity as it relates to sports.
Well, having been a professional athlete for quite a period of time, I know what you're talking about, that transition to the next career, which is often quite hard. I want to touch on one of those skills.
Well, stop there. So you played, what sport were you?
Okay, it's called Australian football.
Australian football. That's the real deal. That's like serious shit, like people getting their ears ripped off and things like that, right?
I never had ears ripped off. A few, broken cheekbone and head stitched up a couple of times and things like
and
that.
And so your whole life, did you know you wanted to be an Australian rules football player?
Yeah, pretty much. I was born in Melbourne, Australia, and it's part of our culture down there. But at the same time, I always had a passion for investing, and that's part of the reason why.
And how long were you a professional athlete for?
16 years.
So, 16 years?
Yeah.
So you had a long career.
Yeah. I got picked up when I was 7. Scott, this podcast isn't about me.
Yeah, you're more interesting.
No.
You're more interesting. So seriously, so you got did it get you to college? Did you get your college paid for? Did you make a good living? Like what?
I was very lucky. I made a good living, but I studied for 15 years straight. Actually, I took one semester off in those 15 years, so I did a bachelor and a master's. And I always knew I was very lucky of what I wanted to do after football, and that's investing. And part of the reason why I wanted to chat with you, Scott, because of some of your beliefs, but also your book.
Hold on. I know you're very self-conscious. You're very self-effacing, but I'll ask a question to you. Of all your teammates, right?
Yeah.
How many of them were able to make extraordinary livings? Like it was worth it to give up their 20s and early 30s. And I think you get a lot of skills from professional sports. Are there a lot of them, though, and I'm kind of leading the question, that didn't make a ton of money and are sort of, you know, in their late 20s and early 30s and trying to figure out, okay, what exactly am I going to do with my life? Because being a star athlete, I would imagine, leads you to believe, like, I can do this the rest of my life. And one of the pieces of advice I give to young people is you want to pick a profession you get better at as you get older, not one you get worse at. So being a model is a terrible profession because every day you get worse at it. And being an athlete, to a certain extent, falls into that category because every day you get a little bit worse at it. Being a female actress, men can be in leading roles when they're in their 50s. Women turn 30 and they're considered over the hill and can play someone's grandmother. It's a terrible business, like a lot of professions. We are very, I don't know, they've been institutionalized. Sexism, but would you say it was a good move for the majority of your colleagues, even the ones that rose to the level that you were at?
It's very hard because a lot of teammates of mine made quite a lot of money at the time, the lifestyle creep and the spending patterns weren't invested the way, I guess, possibly ways that they wished they did at the time. Yeah. And the players that leave the game in a better financial position aren't always the most successful. They were more the ones that
are smarter.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah. The quote that I love from is Isaiah Thomas, who said something like, if all I'm remembered is for being a fantastic basketballer, then I failed with the rest of my life. I love that because I retired from football when I was 33, and that was 3 years ago. And I've got 40, 50 years of working life in front of me, which excites me. But anyway. That's enough about that.
So what team were you on? All right. Dude, you're so much more interesting than me. Do your listeners know you? So wait, what team were you on?
So I had 5 years at a team in Melbourne called Essendon, Essendon Bombers, and I had 11 years at the team in Sydney called the Sydney Swans. And my time at the Sydney Swans was far more successful than my time at the Bombers. But
Did you ever win a cup or whatever? What do they call it down there?
We call it a premiership, premiership cup. I won one in 2012. I lost two, one in 2006.
But you made it to the cup or the final three times.
Three times, yeah.
And were you ever like all league, all pro? Were you like, how extraordinary an athlete were you or are you?
Oh.
Were you all-star? What are the... You are literally turning red right now. You are the most humble athlete I have ever met. So wait, hold on. All right, listeners, we're going to find out about this guy. So were you MVP or All-Pro? What do they call it down there?
I had a good career. In 2012.
Yeah.
Peak? It was a peak. I was very lucky to get to the top.
Yeah.
With an All-Australian selection. But
oh, nice.
Scott, there were times when I thought I was going to get the tap on the shoulder and not offered another contract, get delisted. We could talk about this for a while, Scott.
So this is what I need you to do. Okay. So Australian athletes, first off, it seems like Australians love their sport, but I need you to do me a favor. I need you to find, there's a guy named Scott Galloway, who unfortunately is a midfielder for the Mariners in Australia. And I don't know if he's having a very good career, But he's now coming up in Google before me. So I have an Australian athlete who is literally bumping off Google searches, and he's a midfielder playing for the Something Mariners. He's a soccer player. So I'm hoping he takes up podcasting because I need him out of... The algorithm is finding him more interesting than me.
Well, Scott, we've got something in common because there's a man in Birmingham called Ted Richards that is trying to turn himself into a parrot. He's chopped his ears off and he's tattooed his whole face. So listeners, please do not confuse me with Ted Richards, Parrot Man.
Ted Richards, world-class footballer or parrot? Okay, nice. Good stuff.
All right. Scott, onto the book, The Algorithm of Happiness. If you don't mind, if we speak
back
about,
to me.
Back to me. There's a quote I like, and this is the quote. I tell my students that nothing wonderful, I'm talking really fantastic, will happen without taking a risk and subjecting yourself to rejection. Yep. Serendipity is a function of courage. And so you practice what you preach here as you wrote a popular book about tech.
Yep.
But when the publishers ask you to write another book, you take a risk here. You write another one, but not about tech and platforms, but about happiness and mental models. So before we talk about the book, let's talk about this risk. Firstly, well done. What a great success it is. I loved it.
Thank you.
Were you nervous? Were you nervous about how well it'll be received?
Yeah, you don't. It wasn't so much I was nervous. It was, as my publisher said, the way book publishing or book writing works, and I didn't know this, is if you're fortunate enough for all the moons to line up and you have a successful first book, they immediately want you to do a second because the pump is prime. The distribution channel is like, oh, this book sold well. We can sell a lot of whatever the second is. And so my publisher immediately said, get another book out there. And I said, well, I don't have a vision for one. It doesn't matter. Just get a second one out there. So never buy the second book of any author because it means their publisher just wants them to get shit out in the marketplace. And what I said is, well, I have a vision for a book. It's on happiness. And she said, no. Write the five or the one. Call Sheryl Sandberg a liar. Say Mark Zuckerberg's dangerous, but don't write about happiness. And I decided that was what I was interested in. You know, I try and write as if no one's going to read it but my kids after I'm gone and hopefully know me better. That's my kind of core constituency. I try to be fearless when I write. But back to the risk, it sounds like you're getting into the world of investing. So the only way you can get sort of outsized returns is to take outsized risk. There's a direct correlation between return and risk. And it's scary taking risks with your capital. Less scary when you're young because you can recover, but as you get older, you dial down your risk because you don't have the time to make it back. But in your personal life, as it relates to starting a business when you're young, making overtures and trying to become friends with people, going up to a strange guy or gal and starting a conversation, you know, these things are uncomfortable. They risk public humiliation. They risk ruining your night, or in the case of starting a failed business, it can ruin years. But the people who have outsized returns on their life are the ones who have a tolerance for that type of risk. And it sounds easy to say, but most people aren't willing to do it. Most people aren't willing to sell. They're not willing to call a stranger and ask for a meeting. So immediately, when you really think about it, the majority of people have very, very conservative risk outlooks when it comes to their life. So as a result, there's asymmetric returns to the upside because risk-taking is underinvested. People typically don't have the courage to approach strangers. They don't have the courage to start a business that doesn't exist. They don't have the courage to pursue something that feels risky at the time. So look, you want outsized returns, you got to take outsized risks. There's no getting around it.
You mentioned something there about how you write, and what you talk about is pretty open and raw. There's another quote: "My lack of balance as a young professional cost me my marriage, my hair, and arguably my 20s." So, at a time where so many are out there on social media as fake, were you hesitant about being so open? You mentioned that it's how you you write for your children. Were you nervous about kind of being so open?
No, I try to. I write at night after my family is asleep. I've had a couple beers or I've smoked some pot. So I try to write, and I don't want to call it with reckless abandon because I read what I write and I want to make sure that I didn't say anything too stupid, but I try to write, I really try to say what's on my mind. I have people in my life who love me. I'm economically secure because I got very lucky. And so it blesses me with a certain level of unfiltered opportunities to be unfiltered. A lot of people can't be unfiltered. It's easy to say, oh, speak what's on your mind. But, you know, you say the wrong thing at work, speak in your mind, you could get fired. You say the wrong thing. You know, I occasionally am, quite provocative in class, but if I got fired from NYU, which once they wise up and kick my ass to the curb, that'll happen. A lot of people couldn't absorb that. I can absorb that. So I have the luxury, I think, of being a little bit more forthright or a little bit more unfiltered. And my blog and my writing is the place where I really try to be no chaser and unfiltered. And when I, you know, with certain rules, I try not to be, I'm very critical of people. I make personal attacks and I try to not make them of anyone who's less powerful than me, because that's just bullying. But I think there's a lot of people who are a lot more courageous than me writing about personal experiences and what's happened to them. But it resonates with people. When you're vulnerable, it's a way of expressing, in some ways, friendship to people. Because when you're vulnerable to someone and you talk about your anger or your depression, or I talk about my failed marriage, I think people are pretty, not only forgiving, but they feel closer to you and they're generous back. The statement you're talking about around the 20s, you know, balance is a myth. There's trade-offs. There is no balance. If you want to be super successful, I mean, to get to the point you got to, and as a world-class athlete, you were either like unconsciously genius gifted or you worked your ass off. And traveling around, there's just a lot of sacrifices and if you want to be successful at a young age. And I don't remember much else than working in my 20s, because I decided at a very early age that money was more important to me than lifestyle. And that sounds crass, but I grew up with no money. I decided I wanted it, and I was willing to sacrifice a lot for it. And it was hard on my relationships. It was probably not very good for my health. It was very stressful. But I have a ton of balance now, largely because I traded off that balance. So you just have to have an open conversation with yourself around your priorities.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of many of the messages throughout the book. And there's something that you've already just touched on and that I'd like to discuss, and that is how a lot of people, and you mentioned this throughout the book, a lot of people would like to tell their younger self to be less hard on themselves, which it sounds great, but I reckon I was good at football because I was hard on myself. Yeah. So can you learn grit without being hard on yourself? Because some good things are just damn hard to do.
Yeah, I agreed. So I think the nomenclature is key here, and that is, I think it's really important to be disciplined. You just can't rise to the level you rose to. I don't think you can be a successful entrepreneur without knowing really when to turn on the discipline, and that is working very hard if you're an entrepreneur, as an athlete, pushing yourself exceptionally hard. I don't think you can get to real levels of success without that discipline. I think where the forgiveness comes in is that it's very easy to anchor off the most successful person you know and look back and think, oh, you know, I could have handled that situation so much better, or I had a business fail, or I made a stupid investment and really beat yourself up on, or I could have handled my relationship with my parents or my siblings so much better, or why am I not more successful? And the number one piece of advice in research across when they survey seniors, the number one piece of advice they would give their younger selves is not that they wish they'd chosen different careers, or they had or had not gotten married, or they'd lived somewhere else. The number one piece of advice that older people would give to their younger selves is they wish they'd been more forgiving, that they wish they'd been less hard on themselves. Because anything in the moment, humans are terrible with proportion in the moment. And that is, any good thing that happens to you, you will exaggerate. And any bad thing that happens to you, you will exaggerate. And that is, when something good happens to you, you have a tendency to think it's because of you, not just luck, and think you're very confident and then be very prone to stupid decisions. And when something bad happens to you, you tend to think, oh, I'm an idiot. I should not do anything. I should go home, lock the door, go to sleep forever and not try again. And the reality is, nothing is ever as good or as bad as it seems. So a key to long-term relationships with people is forgiveness. When people screw up, it's important that you forgive them. And two, bringing that same sense of forgiveness to yourself. And that is, when you screw up, give yourself a little bit of time to mourn and then move on. And another kind of one thing I talk about in the book is that, you know, key to success is your ability to mourn and move on, and kind of resilience over failure. Everyone knows failure. Okay, fine. Give yourself a statute of limitations. I'm going to beat myself up for a day, a week, a year, whatever it might be, and then I am on. You know, next is a key word in all of this. Get on to the next. I screwed up. Fine. Next.
I think it's such an important... I played fullback, which is pretty much the last line of defense, and pretty naive to go into games and think that no one's going to score a goal against you. And sometimes you just got to go, all right, that happened, move on. Scott, you talk about myths throughout the book, and you've already touched on one, and that is the myth of balance. I want to talk on about another one, the other myth you mentioned, that is to follow your passion. Can you give us a bit of insight as to why that's a myth?
Well, you're living proof that that's terrible advice, because my guess is football was your passion and it worked out for you. But typically, at NYU, we have two types of people who get to come speak to the kids. The first is really interesting people with something profound to say, and the second are billionaires. For some reason, we've decided anyone that's aggregated $1 billion in wealth has some sort of insight and should be advising young people. And they always end with the same piece of advice: follow your passion. And typically, the person telling you to follow your passion made their billions in iron ore smelting or tax law. And the notion that that was their passion is a bit ridiculous. And typically, the passion industries, and again, there are exceptions here, and the exceptions are very well publicized, are people who get a ton of publicity. But because the passion areas, sports, entertainment, acting, are so overinvested because everybody wants to do them, it's like any asset class. The returns get starched out, except for the top 0.1%. In your industry, I would argue a living wage, the employment rate is probably, or unemployment rate is probably 99%. I mean, for every guy like you that managed to make a good living through his or her 20s, there are 100 people barely eking by, trying to figure out a way, hoping they'll get drafted up into the big leagues, right? It's just such, there's so much more supply than demand. So I would argue that following your passion is dangerous advice. I think that what young people need to do is find out what they're good at. If you're really good at something naturally, you can make the requisite investment in discipline, perseverance, 10,000 hours, putting up with bullshit, because every industry has its own idiosyncrasies and bureaucracy and frustrations, and then become great at it. And if you become great at something, the accoutrements of being great at something, prestige, recognition, camaraderie, financial security, all of those things will make you passionate about whatever it is. No one grows up, no 9-year-old says, I want to be a tax lawyer. But there are people out there who are passionate about tax law because they're really good at it, they find it interesting, they get to fly first class, and they get a broader selection of mates because they're interesting and good at what they do, and people are attracted and drawn to that. So finding your passion means finding something you're good at. The two kind of go hand in hand.
This episode is brought to you by Sixpark. Sixpark is Australia's leading online investment service. Visit sixpark.com.au, take the free online risk assessment, and you'll receive your own investment recommendation over Australian and international shares, infrastructure and property, and defensive asset classes too, like bonds and cash. Sixpark sets up the portfolio for you and manages it too, with your asset allocation overseen by the Sixpark Investment Committee, which includes Brian Watson, the former chairman of JP Morgan and former member of the Board of Guardians for the Australian Government Future Fund, Mark Nicholson, the former co-CIO of the World Bank, and Lindsay Tanner, the former Minister of Finance for the Australian Government. To find out more and to look up show notes for this episode, visit sixpark.com.au. Okay, back to my discussion with Scott Galloway. Something else you mentioned throughout the book is that about finances and how young people focus on how much money they're making and older people start to focus in on their passive income.
Yeah.
Tell us about this and what you've seen.
So young people focus on their income, adults focus on their burn. And so two stories or two families. My father and his wife, between Social Security, my dad's pension from the Royal Navy, and dividend income, they make about their total income is $52,000 a year. They spend $45,000. They're still saving despite the fact he's 89 and she's 88. They're rich. And my dad and his fourth wife are totally dysfunctional when it comes to money. I envision they go home every month at the end of the month and take that additional $2,000 or $3,000, translate it into pennies, and then roll around in it. They're just so obsessed with financial security. They grew up in the Depression, or their kids of the Depression. So it's not how much you make, it's how much you keep, in the sense that you want to bust a move and create a path such that at some point in your life, 40 if you're blessed, 50, 60, 70 for most people, where you've been able to invest in things that give you passive income, whether it's rental property, dividends, stocks, bonds, whatever, such that at some point you have more income greater than your burn. I also have a friend, a close friend, who oversees 11 or 1,200 people at an investment bank, and he makes between $3 and $10 million a year, depending upon the markets. Between an ex-wife, alimony, a house in the Hamptons, and a Master of Universe lifestyle that he's become accustomed to, he spends all of it. And he spends, I think, a couple nights a month staring at the ceiling thinking, what happens when the music stops? I would describe him as poor. And that is his burn is equivalent to and sometimes greater than his passive income. So the definition of rich, full stop, passive income that's greater than your burn. So bust a move to being wealthy.
Great advice. And speaking about investing, a screen that you have with your own investments is if it sounds cool, the less likely you're going to be to invest in it. The more boring, the more likely you are to invest, as these are areas often underinvested. Is that what made WeWork so alluring for many, do you think? Was it Adam Neumann actually kind of making it all sound so cool?
Yeah. The concept is there's an inverse correlation between sex appeal of a business and return. So a buddy of mine starting a members-only club downtown, focusing on music and art, that sounds super cool. I won't get near it with my own money. Because typically, if you look at the kind of romance industries, restaurants, investing in movies, these things typically have a pretty low return. Whereas if someone approaches me and I invest in a company that's a SaaS, software as a service company focusing on scheduling healthcare maintenance workers, I smell money. And it goes back to the field you're in, Ted, and that is, asset classes that are underinvested typically have higher returns because they can't find capital, and so they have to offer them greater returns. And businesses that sound interesting, I would love to invest in movies. That sounds like a lot of fun because I get to get invited to cool stuff. I find typically you want to stay away from that stuff because it's kind of the, if you go to Teterboro, the private airport here, and you look around and you ask, and I've done this, I've asked pilots, who owns that jet or people, it's Main Street billionaires. And yeah, there's a lot of billionaires in music and sport, and obviously the tech people get a lot of press. But where most billionaires come from is the guy that's selling that cabling, the person that figured out, you know, the electronics behind that light, kind of low tech, or the person who's figured out a way to put asbestos in or take it out of these walls we're in right now. I've found there's an inverse, again, a negative correlation between how attractive an industry sounds and its returns. If you want to go to work for Vogue, if you want to open nightclubs, you better get a lot of psychic income because on a risk-adjusted basis, your returns are just going to be lower.
WeWork has become a really iconic story. I read in one of your articles that you've been approached by three media firms about being the executive producer of the WeWork story.
Yeah.
Any updates on this, Scott?
Yes, Scott's going Hollywood. That's right, Australia. Oh, my God. So this is an indicator of a lot of things. One is, there's going to be more money spent on original scripted television this year, mostly because big tech is getting into the TV business or the production business, than was spent on the entire 90s. So we're now spending in any given year what we spent on decades. So it's a great time to be in the business or love watching TV. I think in 100 years, no joke, we're going to look back on this era and the defining art form will be television. There is amazing television. Typically, TV was full of people who couldn't make the jump to movies. Now the most talented people in any media globally are coming into American scripted television because there's just so much money in it. That is overinvested, and it's so overinvested that they're so desperate for content that I'm getting approached by people to do documentaries. And when a guy like me, who doesn't necessarily have any obvious talent for writing or producing documentaries, has opportunities to do it, it means that the space is overinvested. But the WeWork drama here, and I don't know how well people know about it in Australia. Does WeWork have offices in Australia?
Yeah, Melbourne,
everywhere?
Sydney, yeah, pretty much every major capital city.
I didn't know that. Okay, so you guys know about WeWork. Yeah. So here it's it's almost sort of the seminal tale that kind of indicates the age that we're in, where we have a charismatic founder, the idolatry of innovators, cheap capital, this $100 billion Vision Fund. The SoftBank Fund, Vision Fund, is bigger than the entire amount of capital deployed by venture capitalists in 1996. So take an entire year of capital deployment in the go-go years in the 90s, and that's just what, you know, Vision One Fund is that big. So it was sort of the perfect storm, and it's a very interesting tale, and it's going to make for a good movie because you have this interesting kind of dreamy guy with Jesus-like hair and his wife, who I'm sure will be depicted as someone who was weird, and they used to be charismatic and neurotic in a good way, but now that a lot of people have lost a lot of money, they'll be depicted as these strange Jim Jones-like characters. But you're going to see a lot of media come out around it.
Fair to say there's still more chapters to come?
Oh, Look, for those of you who've been following it, SoftBank just bailed them out to the tune of, I think, another $8 billion. Or is it 11? I don't know. The numbers are just getting so funny now. I think WeWork will be to SoftBank what Afghanistan and Vietnam were to Russia and the U.S. respectively. I think it just gets worse from here. You know, this is the most expensive face-saving move in history.
Lessons that we're learning from WeWork. Some are suggesting some other similarities with Uber, which is another business with a negative margin. There's another quote that you said, there are a few products that scale, like a dollar offered for 50 cents. Let's compare WeWork to Uber. What do you see playing out with Uber?
So Uber, to be fair, Uber has real value. It's a global brand, the globally affluent. It's probably the first and last brand you will interact with here in the United States.
You're right. Yeah, I'm using it a lot.
And it'll be the first and last brand you interact with when you get back to your to your homeland. It's got great technology. They've managed to coordinate, I think, 4 million driver partners. It's wonderful technology. There's real value there. And at some point, they could raise the prices to the point where it would be, I think, a profitable company. That company is just dramatically overvalued. We like to think that, you know, they called out their total addressable market. Whenever you see TAM in an investment prospect or you hear someone talking about it in an investment presentation, run for the hills. Because Uber said, okay.
So for those that are not familiar with TAM, total addressable market?
That's exactly. Size of the market. And so according to Uber, their total addressable market is the $4 trillion transportation market. That's a little bit, that should raise some red flags. So Uber has grown fast. It's a big company. But in order to grow that fast, it offered negative operating margins. That's about, I think, 20% gross margins. But effectively, it's economically irresponsible not to take Uber everywhere because you're getting $15 worth of transportation for 10 bucks. And we saw this in the late 90s. You could order a $50 bag of dog food for 30 bucks.
Pets.com?
Pets.com. You could have, let's play this, dot bomb geography. Where could you order a pint of Ben & Jerry's and have it delivered within an hour to your house for less than it would cost to walk to a Safeway or a 7-Eleven? You remember that one?
That, but having been in Australia.
There you go.
Yeah.
Cosmo or Urban Fetch,
okay.
Right? Cyber Shop, $1 billion market cap because they were buying $30 Furbies and selling them for $19.99. So you're right. If you and I started selling dollar lottery tickets for 60 cents, we could build a big business. And this was all kind of catalyzed by Amazon that had really low gross margins and still became the third most valuable company in the world. So people took it, or investors and entrepreneurs took it to an absolutely different level and came up with such low margins that resulted in such incredible growth that they would never get to operating margin. So Uber's a real business, just dramatically overvalued. I think WeWork could go to zero. My prediction, and I made this prediction a few months ago and I was wrong, that it was going to be a bankruptcy by the end of 19. That's not going to happen. I think it could still be a bankruptcy because I think they've imprinted such an incredibly high cost structure. I'm not sure they're ever able to dig out.
I read another piece of yours where you talk about being on TV more now. Because of your early calls on WeWork. And here's the quote. I need to focus on margin, my value add at home, being more present with my kids and being a more engaged partner. I thought that this quote was so great because once again, going back to the book, The Algebra of Happiness, these are the things that are important. I think that's just a great way to tie it out because despite all the success you've had around your work and your professional life and your calls with WeWork, you're still focusing in on practicing what you preach,
or at least claiming to. I don't know. You try to be I do so much virtue signaling in my blog posts, and I talk a lot about family and the importance of friendships. And I'm just trying to foot to those writings because sometimes I just feel like I'm a little bit full of shit. And especially with my family, you know, gross margins is a great concept. Any business should look at its gross margins. What is your value add in the supply chain? When you take a given set of resources that cost X, are you able to do something that creates 2X, 1.1X? It's a great value add. And I find that it's dangerous, and I think this is true of a lot of people who are very focused on their career. It's good that I'm focused on the long term. I'm constantly thinking about my career. I'm at home. I'm thinking about work. I take economic security and being, you know, responsible for economic security for my family very seriously. And also, I have a huge ego. I want to be relevant. It's the closest thing I think I have to immortality is to try and, you know, just be relevant in the world outside of the people I know. But what you find is if you're so focused on that kind of growth, if you will, and this is the analogy and it gets a bit weak here, day to day, are you just distant and not engaged with your kids? Your kids don't. Your kids want to make, you know, your kids want to have food, but they want engaged parents. Does your partner feel like she or he has a partner? And so as I get older, I'm trying to be more engaged and more in the moment. It's something I really struggle with because long term, you need to be a good partner, a good father, a good provider. But day to day, you got to be in the moment and present. It's something I really struggle with. And kids just want you in the moment. Kids just want you there. That's it. And I find that a lot of times I'm physically there, but that's about it.
The other references in the book about holding your son's hand. I've got a son who's 3 and a daughter who's 2. And
In the thick of it.
I am in the
thick. Oh, my God.
And that's why it's so good being in New York.
You love it here.
Couple of days away from the kids.
Well rested.
Yeah. Yep.
Here's the bad news. They're awful at that age. The good news is they get less and less awful every day. Like 0 to 2, no value add for the father. I think they should drop them off a 6-pack of kids when we're 2, when they're 2. 2 to 3, bearable. 3 on is pretty good, and like 5, 6 on is just magic. It gets better and better every year.
Thanks. If listeners would like to find out more, the book is called Algebra of Happiness, and as always, show notes will be available on the 6PARC website. Before we wrap it up, if listeners want to find out more, Scott, you have your own podcast called Pivot. Yep. Can you tell us a bit about that?
So I co-host a podcast on big tech with Kara Swisher called Pivot. We're also launching a podcast called Office Hours with Prof. G. And my new firm is called Section 4, which is kind of streaming short form MBA. So I'm all over the place here. I've got, there is no resisting. Well, Australia to resist is futile. Amazon is coming and so is the big dog.
Well, I follow them all on Twitter, and yeah. you've produced some fantastic content.
Thanks
so, where can they find you on social media?
Prof Galloway on Twitter, section4.com. That's enough. You can find everything there, or just Google me on YouTube, and hours of mindless pleasure of an angry, depressed professor barking at you.
Professor Scott Galloway, the big dog.
That's right.
Thanks very much for the chat on the Richards Report.
Thank you.